Viewers, listeners, welcome to another edition of Blighty Talks Bricks. My guest today is somebody that I met a few years ago in a village pub in East Hertfordshire where both of us reside. We might come on to how we actually got introduced later on, but I started talking to this gentleman, was struck by his personality, found out that he was ex-military. Not something new for me, because over the years I've met lots of people in the military. I'm a big fan of the British military and also the emergency services. But what did intrigue me about this gentleman was that he actually worked in the UXB squad, dealt with unexploded bombs, which I don't know why I found interesting, but I did. But when we got talking, I found out that he'd actually been the man, the person that dealt with a World War II bomb that had come down from the German RAF, I don't know what they called them, to be perfectly honest.
Luftwaffe,
there we go, Luftwaffe. Left behind, and 17 years ago, this man had the pleasure, I don't know if you call it pleasure, Isha, but had the job of actually getting rid of this bomb. And where he actually got rid of it was actually on a road that, as a kid, I walked over with my parents. Many a time with my mum, she'd take me down to Roman Road Market on a Saturday afternoon. I've probably walked over that area and around that area hundreds and hundreds of times. So it's just sort of struck with me that my life could have been very different. He's a great guy, and I've been on his case for a little while to get him on just to talk about that. But you don't want to listen to me rattle on. Let me just introduce my guest today, Dougie Leek. Dougie, welcome to Blighty Talks Bricks.
Thank you very much.
We normally talk about trying to put bricks down. I suppose in your case, you was trying to stop bricks going up in the air, wasn't you?
Yeah, that's one way to put it, yeah, to stop them falling down rather than putting them down.
Before we go on to that particular event, how did you get into the military?
I came from a small village, and there was a village when I lived there. It's a town now, but a small place called Moffat, which is about 15 miles north of Lockerbie. I normally tell people I'm from Lockerbie because people have heard of that for obvious reasons. But I'm not. I'm actually further north from a little place called Moffat. And to be honest, once every 3 years, you'll have four of the kids that leave school will get trades. One will become a plumber, you've got the sparky, you've got the bricky, and you've got the carpenter. They do their apprenticeship. 3 years later, you get another four that get jobs. The majority of the rest either go to college, university, they work in at the time it was the forestry or the motorways, or they joined the military. I did have the chance. I was going to be the plumber. Right. However, I did my work experience with the plumbing firm, and in the time between finishing the work experience and leaving school, then I went shopping with a friend in Dumfries. He was going to do his enlistment test for the military. I was going to get a set of jeans.
But you went out to buy a pair of jeans with a friend that was going to enlist in the British Army.
I did. I sat in the careers office while he was doing his exam, and the staff sergeant at the time said, you need to go through there to do this exam. I said, I'm not joining the army. He said, why not? I said, because I don't want to. And he said, okay. He said, but you can sit there for 20 minutes, or you can come and do an exam for 20 minutes and it'll pass the time quicker. So I said, all right. I went and sat the exam. And when he came back, he said, these three have done okay, but this guy, you might need to speak to him. And I was looking around for someone else. And the officer said, why? And he said, I think we've got someone that might go somewhere. I stayed for an hour later, and I walked back with some papers because I was under 18. I was under 17 at the time. I walked back with some papers, walked into the house and asked my mum and dad, can you sign these, please? And they said, what for? I said, I think I've just joined the army.
that's a true story.
That is
and you basically went back to mum and dad and said, by the way, I think I've joined the army.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
He said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "Well, reading the small print, you have to do 4 weeks training, and after 4 weeks, if you don't like it, then you can leave. You can volunteer to leave." So I said, "I'm only joining for 28 days. If I don't like it, I'll come home." In the end, I spent 24 and a half years, and they kicked me out because I couldn't do any longer. So my 28 days turned into...
Your mate never joined?
He did, but he left after about 3 years.
Did he?
He did, yes.
So where did you go to from there? So a few days later, you're on a bus or a train to go training somewhere?
A few months later, I went down to Camberley to the home of the... Well, one of the homes of the Royal Engineers, because that's who had joined. Because I wanted to get a trade, and that's the Royal Engineers. Yes, they're soldiers, but they also get trades as well, because obviously we're the craftsmen when you go out to theatres who build the infrastructure, who put in the accommodation, the electrics, the plumbing and everything else. So I wanted to get a trade because I knew I wasn't going to be in the army forever. So I needed something when I left. So I went down to Gibraltar Barracks, did the phase one basic training, and then phase two, which is your combat engineer training. I did that there, and then I got shipped out to Germany as my first post, which was an eye-opener.
You've left home, you've done your training, you're obviously taking to it, you're obviously enjoying it.
Yeah.
Did you ever feel that you was going to end up dealing with unexploded bombs on this circle journey?
Not at all.
So when did that one land on your desk, so to speak? When did you realise I'm going into to do that kind of role in the army? I mean, being in the military is dangerous anyway.
Yeah.
To actually deal with unexploded bombs seems even more dangerous to me.
Well, while I was in Germany, I came back from to the UK on a driving course. I was to be a light armoured vehicle driving instructor. It was a reconnaissance vehicle that the military used, called a Spartan. So I was going to be a Spartan instructor and teach other people how to drive these mini tanks. That course was 6 weeks down in Bovington. While I was there, there was nothing to do the weekend, and coming from Scotland, I can't go back to Scotland on a Friday night and be back in work for 8 o'clock on Monday morning.
A tough journey, yeah.
So I went back to one of the other lads who was on the course. He lived in Hemel Hempstead. So I went back there with him, and in the queue of a nightclub, then I met the lady that turned into my wife.
Right.
It was a bit strange because me and her really didn't like each other to start with, but we got dragged along to make up the four.
Normally happens the other way. You like each other in the beginning, then you end up not liking each other.
Well, luckily it worked the other way for me. We've just had the 25th anniversary, so it's worked all right. But yeah, so me and her got dragged along to make up the foursome. Those two, it lasted about 2 weeks. And here we are, 25 years later, just...
So did that put a not a spoke, but did that start to dictate where you wanted to go with the military?
I then started to look, unlike infantry units tend to get posted as a whole group. Royal Engineers get posted as individuals. So there's lots of locations throughout the world that you can go to. Now, trying to engineer it so that you get where you choose...
It's difficult.
Yeah, it's very, very hard. But when I was in Germany, I had to come back... After the driving course, I came back to do my trade. And I was unfortunate enough that I didn't get to be a carpenter, a bricklayer, a plumber, or a sparky. I was a toolmaker. I spent 2.5 years working on a lathe or on milling machines and grind machines, doing everything.
Things we don't believe go on in the army.
Yeah. Well, funny enough, they've just... got rid of that trade.
Have they just stopped that?
Yes.
Okay, fine, okay.
So I spent 2.5 years learning how to do it to never actually do it after I left the college. However, the college is in Chatham. So that was commuting distance to my wife's family's location, which was Bishop Stortford. So on a Wednesday afternoon or the weekend, then I would go from Chatham to Bishop Stortford and I would stay with my wife and her parents. From there... You get posted again. There's a whole selection of places you can go, but I thought the closest I can get is Cambridge.
Right.
So I went to Cambridge. Now, Cambridge was an air support regiment. So I went into a new role, completely, never done it before, so completely new to me. And it was basically supporting the RAF. So we would go out to places throughout the world and we'd put in the infrastructure. We'd make runways, we'd put helicopter landing pads, we'd put Harrier jump jet pads or test pads. We'd build the accommodation. The RAF would come in, they would do their business, flying around, doing what they were doing. They would leave, then we strip it all out.
You take it all out and take it back and put it up somewhere else in a roundabout way.
But that was Cambridge, and that was great. While I was there, someone... I'd been spotted as a potential Royal Engineer instructor. Now, that's a role that you get selected for.
Okay.
It's not a role that many people choose to do. The instructor's course, it used to be notoriously hard. It's to take the new recruits through basic training, but they work on the ethos is you need to know what the recruits are feeling when you go through. They seem to forget that you went through as a basic training recruit at one point. So they actually treat you far worse than you could ever treat anyone. And it's just to see if you can make
see if you've got the balls to stand up to the pace, if you like.
Yeah, and it's worse than you'd ever dream of doing to anyone, but that's what the kudos was. I ended up going through the instructor's course. Now, there was two places I could go. I could be a combat engineer instructor at Camberley, or I could go and be a basic training phase one instructor at ATR Bazenbourne, which is Royston.
Yeah. Closer now, and closer to Bishop Stortford. You're doing well.
It was. So you had two options. The Camberley side was your combat engineering side. The Royston is your infantry side. So you got assessed on two lessons. And whatever one you excelled in, then that's where they put you because they wanted the best at each place. So when it came to teaching people how to wash and cook in a field and how to live in a field, I pulled out all the stops just to be as good as I could.
Yeah.
And when it came to knots and lashings, then there was a couple of things that I didn't quite tie right, or there was a running end.
So
that
you've
shouldn't
manipulated
have been a running.
Where your location is.
Yeah, so that they
very
said
clever.
So that they put me to Royston, which was 17 miles from my house. But that couldn't last forever. It's only a 2-year post. And at the end of that, that big world opens up again where I could have got put anywhere in the world. And I thought, what regiment is closest to me? Closest to my wife's location? And it was the 3-3 Engineer Regiment Explosive Ordnance Disposal, the bomb disposal.
You did know what you were signing up to then?
Yeah, I knew it was bomb disposal, but it meant I was only 14 miles away from my now wife, my girlfriend.
That's real love, isn't it?
Yeah, so...
So, you signed up to that. You're obviously bright. You're obviously academically good. You can... Whatever you've done in the army, you've done it well. Did you know that at some point that was going to take you into real harm's way? I mean, the military is a tough place anyway.
Yeah. The thing with the military is... You're always aware somewhere in the periphery, you know that you're going to get put in somewhere that it's going to be dangerous. It could be life-threatening.
Yep.
But it's there until you have to deal with it. So it floats around in everyone's peripheral vision, but nobody really acknowledges. It's the white elephant. Nobody actually acknowledges that it's going to happen.
Yep.
And that's what I was. I was floating around in the world of bomb disposal, knowing that it could happen. But just when? That was it.
And do you work your way up in the bomb disposal unit? Do you start off with a smaller unexplosed device and then, does it work not that way?
No, it's rank based, so you have to have a certain level of experience just as a manager, because a lot of the bomb disposal task is task scene management, making sure people are in the right place with the right stuff at the right time. So management comes into a lot of it. So you have to be a certain rank. So you had to be a sergeant or above.
And with what rank did you, when you left the army, what was you?
I was a warrant officer class 2. So I'd got as high as I could.
Right.
So I was enlisted filth. I was
enlisted,
enlisted filth rather than commissioned. So I did my full 22, and then I stayed on for 2 years extra. They offered me a thing called voluntary engagement or variable engagement, which is a 2-year contract. And it meant 2 years remaining in the bomb disposal world, but again, I'd moved into the area and I was 14 miles from my house.
So bomb disposal, was there any, I mean, we'll come on to the Roman Road incident in a while.
Yeah.
Was there any sort of scary or worrying situations that you dealt with?
Yeah, we obviously, I went out to, with the bomb disposal unit, I went out to Kosovo. I did my Bosnias and stuff before I was bomb disposal, but I went out to Kosovo for a period of time with them, which wasn't too bad, to be honest. It was relatively...
That sort of landmine stuff? And
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
See, already I'm starting to sweat just the thought of going into a field not knowing where these bloody things are.
Yeah, but you need to know how to get into the field.
No, I don't. I don't want to go.
that's the secret. So I did that, and then we did the pre-tour training, the specialty theatre training for Iraq, and we went out to Iraq, the specialty theatre stuff. I'm not going to say it's a bit more interesting, but it's a bit different to the actual advanced bomb disposal course, because you cover a lot of booby traps and yeah. homemade stuff and IEDs.
So you've seen some terrible sights as well.
Yeah, there's been some rough, and lost far too many friends that are never coming back from the long walk, the long lonely walk. They're not coming back from that. But
so, if I want to take you back 17 years,
yeah,
there's a phone call. How does that journey start? Where does somebody, was it on a building site?
Yes, it was. A building site.
I mean, we are literally three minutes away from it.
We are. I walked up there this morning. So,
your first time back as well?
It was, first time in 17 years.
But so where are you at the time when this phone call comes in?
I think I was at Tesco's. I was on the way home from being at camp on just doing the day-to-day stuff, but I was on duty as the duty bomb disposal operator. And you used to carry, it was so long ago, you used to carry pagers.
Is that what it was?
Yeah.
And and have you got an area then? Is that,
no
area?
UK.
UK. Okay.
I'd had a run of call-outs. Every time I got the pager, someone seemed to find something. And I had various call-outs, so it was becoming a standing joke. When my name became on orders, was published on orders, you'd get other people trying to swap duties to get on with me. Because it almost was 8 out of 10 times I was going out somewhere.
Really?
But I was going around Tesco's. I had to buy some, I think it was ibuprofen for my wife, she had a headache. Going round the roundabout, my pager went. So I had to go round the roundabout again and back into Tesco's car park. I phoned her and said, the pager's gone. I'll let you know what's happening. I then looked at the pager and it says, report to the operations room. So hightailed it back from Bishop Stortford to Wimbish, which is just outside Saffron Walden, about 12 miles, into the operations room as I'm trying to get dressed into uniform. And they said, yeah, we've got something, we've got a building site who've reported a possible UXO piece in London. There's the postcode. Your crew, the crash crew, should all be waiting on you, which they are, because their pagers go as well.
Do you get a police escort or
no? So the driver off the army response vehicle, it's blue lighted,
right?
So depending on the situation, then depends on whether you can blue light or not.
Yep.
Normally they say you can't blue light unless it's
they think this is dangerous.
Unless it's imminent,
right?
While nobody's touching the munition on the building site, then it's no blue lights. So we came down to London, met the police who'd put in a provisional cordon at the top of Palmer's Road. Met them, their chief inspector. I went across as the operator, introduced myself, and he said, if you want to take a walk down, I'll show you where it is.
So this, when you get to that stage, do you then put your gear on, or you just stroll down to
just stroll down.
That scares the living daylights out of me. You know what's down there, and somebody's found it. And you're just going to then wander down and have a little look at it.
Yeah.
I suppose so, you've got a cup of coffee as
this,
well.
This is it? Just the confirmation part. This is just so it's not an old oil drum or something else. So
okay.
The policeman took me down, the chief inspector took me down, and he said, it's over there.
I'm the same as him, yeah.
Anyway, it's over there. If you go, just go round
that, round that corner and have a look down that hole.
And I thought, all right. So I went down, walked around, and as soon as I seen it, I thought, oh, yes, that's a belter.
That's a belter.
Yeah, that's
you're
a big
You're smiling. You seem happy about this news. You know, I'd be going, oh, for fuck's sake.
But the thing is, you train all the time. It's a little bit like you get sports personalities who say that they train for the
you're
thing.
You're in the zone.
And if you miss the Olympics, you've missed out. So I've trained for this. I've done other munitions as well. So it's not my first one.
No. I get
so
that.
So I see this
and
one.
And you've seen some terrible sights that have gone back on him, back, you know, in Iraq and in Kosovo. Yeah. I see that. But so you go down there and you go, as you call it, this is a belter.
Yeah, there we go. That's a big
That's a ball. Proper one.
Yeah, that'll keep us busy. So I go back and I say to the police, that's definitely it's definitely a World War II bomb. I think you need to extend your cordon a bit.
So how far would they have moved people away at that particular time?
They hadn't. They just told people to stay in the house.
Right.
Or stay in their houses. And the area itself is surrounded by flats and...
I know.
Yeah.
It's as I said to you just before we started the episode that... I found out at the weekend that where they moved some of the people away and they had nowhere to go, they went to my old secondary school, which for me it was called Daneford, but at that time it was called the Bethnal Green Academy.
Right.
So even more apparent, I bump into you in the village pub, and we start talking. Yes, I've walked over that part of the world so many times. Just unbelievable.
Yeah.
So you've got a belter.
Yeah.
What's the next app? What happens next?
So I then get in touch with... the regiment and say I'm going to need a senior EOD commander, and that's an officer who comes down and basically they're there to do press control because
you've got
the
to
press
move
are
it back, you've got to get people out and all the press are going to be all
the
over this.
The press are coming because we're evacuating a lot of people in the centre of London for a World War II bomb, so they are coming. So I don't have enough time
to deal
with them and the munition, so someone else come along and do that. So he came along, and he's now the liaison between me and everyone else, the police, the public, everything else. I only talk to him, and that's it. I get left alone.
You get left alone. Do they set like a little marquee or tent or something like that?
Yeah, so you've got an inner cordon, which is inside that, it's just us.
Right.
And then you've got your outer cordon, where the public are outside that. And in between, the police and my senior EOD commander would jump in between.
And this bomb is so big that you can't just sort of try and blow it up.
The danger radius, when you look at the information that they've gathered through testing, if it's in an empty space on a flat ground and it explodes, you'll have shrapnel fly in a radius 1.6
kilometres. 1.6 kilometres.
So a mile. So diameter-wise, on a flat space, then it could fly 2 miles. Diameter,
right.
But the area itself is surrounded by high-rise buildings, and they're not new buildings. They're not off the grid.
And you can't send that. I'm going to call it Rover, the dog thing, down. You can't because it's in a hole anyway, and you can't send that down.
The Royal Engineers never used to use robots. Everything
Did
was
they
by
not?
Hand. The Royal Logistic Corps used to use the robots, whereas we just done everything by hand.
I've been watching too many films, haven't I?
A little bit. They knew they'd use robots now, but we never used this, so there was no option for a robot for me.
So you now know that you are right on it, aren't you? You are.
Yeah.
You've got your belter. You now know that, and I mean this nicely, you're sort of on your own.
It is. Got to be on my own.
So what's the next stage there? You've got your man, the presser sort of kept informed but away.
Yeah.
You're in your little tent, as I call it, where you're getting yourself ready. You know it's big. What starts to go? Do you have any? Do you just? Are you so into training and professional mode that my lovely wife's at home?
I can't think that.
That doesn't come into play at all.
It could, but can't.
Right. Okay.
So you've got to the way that I I approach things, and some people might be the same. They might be different, but. I've got to remove myself from everyone. I can't have friends. I can't have family. I can't be the father. I can't be the son. I can't be the husband.
Right. Okay.
I can't be that. I can't be your friend. I've got to, for that time, I've only got to be me and nothing else. Because if I start to worry about what are they thinking, what happens
your
if...
Your mind's not on the job.
Yeah, I've got to be so selfish that there's the only person in the world at that time is me.
So you're in the zone, so to speak. Have you gone back again, just to double check? Or?
Once we establish what the bomb is and the bigger cordons go in, it's up to me to make an approach. Excuse me, because I need to find out what the fuse is, because you've got different types of fuses. You've got fuses that should have burst, they should have went off in the air, they should have detonated the bomb in the air. You've got ones that are impact, you've got ones that are delay fuses, so they'll hit the ground and go off after a period of time. It could be mechanical, it could be electrical, it could be chemical. So you don't know.
Okay.
So you need to go up and try and identify.
All you know, this came from the Luftwaffe. Yes. That's all you know.
That's it. Okay. And
it's big.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I then have to go up and try and establish. Bear in mind, it's been in the ground.
It's not in mint condition, so to speak, is it?
It's not in the best of nick. So you're down there with a paintbrush and bottles of water just to try and wash debris off and try and see any lettering.
Are you wearing anything then? I mean, because when we spoke at the time, I think I said to you very ignorantly, but I see on films, too many films, people walk down with this protective suit on. And I've always sat there and thought, well, if that thing goes off, that's not going to do. And I did say this to you at the time, that doesn't really do a lot of good. But you tell me, just remind me again.
Yeah, no, it's I've never put one of those suits on in my life.
Do you not have to wear it at all? People do?
People do, depending on what the munition is. I personally have never put one on. Body armour you put on. But as the task was going on and the area around the bomb was getting tighter and tighter, what with protective works and anti-blast stuff, and I couldn't get in. So
such a small area.
So I would wear it from the control point. I'd wear it on the walk down. But when... The bomb's as close as closer than me and you.
You've got to be able to operate.
I've got to be able to get close to it. So before I went in, I would take everything off.
Why did you wear it in the beginning, just in case if it goes off, you're far enough away, you've got a little bit of protection, or is that not even the reason?
If you're a good distance away, then yes, you have got protection. But when you're as close as
it's not going to make any difference.
It collects DNA.
DNA for actually just to say, unfortunately,
a coroner needs something to put on a death certificate. Okay. So if they can't establish who you are, you can't get a death certificate. Okay. So that's the only
it's
reason.
Amazing, isn't it?
It's the only thing it can.
I remember you telling me it at the time and just being, wow, that was the reason. So you are now as close as we are now. You've got your little paintbrushes.
Yeah.
I've got some water to get the rust and the dirt off. At what point, was there any point in there that you thought, this is actually a lot worse than I expected it to be?
You're close and personal. It's now, it sounds strange, but I'm now forming a relationship with the bomb.
Is that the way you feel?
Talking to it. Come on, be nice. Be nice to me.
Be nice to me. It's interesting. I'm not religious, but sometimes I just go, God, give us help, mate. And I'm not religious, really.
He wouldn't help today. The only thing that would help that day is the bomb. So I was talking to the bomb. Be nice to me. Come on, tell me your secrets. What type of fuse are you? Come on, please.
Did we have any records then as to what kind of bombs they were, or not really?
There's historic bombs that have been dropped and what have been found previously. So
did you know sort of what you was working
by
with?
By the size and the shape of it, then I knew it was a general purpose 1,000-pound bomb.
1,000-pound bomb. Yeah. That sounds...
Yeah, it's big. It's big. So
what
that,
this thing, what is it, 6 foot in, I don't know, in length?
Similar to the size of the
sofa.
Chesterfield, yeah.
Made me worried now, I'm just checking. just be nice to me, sofa.
Yeah, exactly. So I knew by the shape, I could tell by the shape and the size what it was, what it had been designed to do. I just need to know what the fuse was, because that would dictate on what I could do to the fuse. Now, the fuse, you can never neutralise it, if you want to use that word.
You can't, it's not like when I watch my film again, you get to leave me little things, my scissors out, and I go, is it red or blue? And it's not like that.
No. You can desensitise it, but you can't ever guarantee it's not going to go off. So you just make it a little bit less. It's like giving a four-year-old Calpol. It's less likely to ruin the party. So that's what I was doing. I discovered what type of fuse it was. I knew that I had to inject a certain solution into the case and around the fuse, not into the fuse, but into the case and around. And that was like me giving it Calpol, just to make it a little bit dopey.
Really?
So that perhaps if I'd knocked it, it might not decide to go crazy.
When my granddaughter's on, won't it? I'm going to think differently about Calpol now.
But yeah.
So how long are you now working on this? I mean, since you've had the in test case, that's gone pear-shaped.
Yeah.
Your missus is at home with a headache.
Yeah.
How many hours are we into this journey to where you are now, where you've put a bit of Calpol into it?
For injecting the fuse, I'm probably now on day three.
Have you had any sleep?
I had a couple of hours at Bethnal Green fire station. The first night we didn't have any because we were too busy. The second night we went there for a couple of hours, but they had a shout to a tragic accident on a subway, so they were dealing with their own trauma. So we left because having two events, they were going to rub each other up the wrong way. So we went back to the site. So we had a couple of hours in Bethnal Green fire station.
And your training, lack of sleep makes me miserable. Tetchy.
Yeah.
Probably concentration drifts a bit. I appreciate that you and your new friend, did you name it?
I didn't, know.
No. So your new friend, your...
It's like a farmer naming a pet that's going to slaughter. You can't give it a name.
You can't get too attached.
No.
Yeah, I get that. Yeah.
Okay.
So you're aware. Is there a time issue for you? Because A, you're getting tired. The thing, I suppose you could look at it, the thing's been there 50 years, another couple of hours, maybe not, maybe, but as you're playing with it and poking it.
Yeah.
Do you not think I've got to get on with this because of the sleep side of it? Does that not come into play?
There was, and on the third night, then someone had said to the senior EU commander, and they'd came and approached me and they said, look, what we're thinking about is getting someone else to come in and you can do a handover takeover and they'll take on because you've been here 3.5 days now. Don't you dare take that bomb off me. That's mine. I've now got an epiphany with that.
I would have bitten my hand off and been straight out. Over to you, pal. Away you go with it. Good luck.
But no, that was me and that bomb. It was me against that. It was like a game of chess. When I got told you had to walk down to it, and they said there's a 1 in 3 chance that you come back from this, so.
A 1 in 3.
Yeah, they said.
So you're providing some data back to your colleagues. You're doing the front end bit. Your colleagues are working. You're talking about this. There's lots of data we've collected over 50 years. And now we reckon it's a 1 in 3 chance this is going to go.
2 in 3 chance.
2 in 3, sorry. 2 in 3
chance it was going to go when I was working on it. So I had 33% of walking away.
And is there a final... cut, is there a final snip or thing that you have to do where, if I get this wrong, it goes?
When you cut it open.
Right.
So I then have to, once I've injected the fuse, I've given it its Calpol, it's a little bit less volatile than it has been. What you have to do is you have to remove the explosive from the case. And you can do that through using high temperature steam. But you need to cut the bomb in two different places so that you can put...
When you're cutting it, with an electric saw, a hand saw, how are we...
We used to have a great big... I said that as if I was still in the military.
Once in the military, always in the military.
Yeah, yeah. But they used to use a thing called a trepanning head, which was a big milling cutter. And for a toolmaker, I'd be all over that. But they'd taken that out of service not long before this bomb was discovered, and they'd brought in a thing called abrasive cutting equipment, but nobody tried it on a real bomb until that day that I had to use it.
So you was the first one?
Yeah, and that's when I said, when we were injecting this very, very high pressured, if you imagine the coating on an air emery board,
yep.
If you imagine that getting pressured needle fine injectors at very, very high pressure, enough that the abrasion is going to cut the case of a bomb. That's how we get into the explosives. I asked the question, I said, so what's this abrasive fluid going to do to the explosive inside? That's when they said, well, there's three types of explosive. They told me what the three were. I can only remember two of them now, but they told me what the three were, and they said two of them are very, very likely and probably will go bang. One, you should be okay. And I said, okay.
I didn't know.
And I said, okay, so how do I know which one I've got? He said, well, we start cutting. But, right, so I don't know what one I'm going to have. And I said, well, not until you cut. I thought...
So, okay. You now have got this information. Did you have to say, okay, I'm going to deal with this, but I'm just going to wander back up there and have one cup of tea or...
Yeah, that's when I went back. There was a WRVS tea wagon that had set up on the bridge with two lovely, lovely ladies serving tea. And I went back and I asked for a white tea and put some sugar in. And I stood where I stood today on the bridge looking down the canal, just on my own, having this cup of tea. And I was probably there for 15, 20 minutes. Nobody came near me, they just left me alone. I finished my cup of tea. I didn't go back because in that 20 minutes I was getting myself ready. So I didn't go back to the tea wagon to put my cup in the bin. I left it on the side by the bridge, a little brug. Left it on the side by the bridge. And the only person that spoke to me was the senior UD commander, who came across and he said, you all right? I said, yeah. And he said, so what do we do? I said, I don't think it's we. I said, I think I've got to go down and do this, don't I? And he went, are you sure? Oh, somebody's going to do it. And he went, okay. And it's going to be you? I said, yeah, it'll be me. And he said, thank God you said that, because they might have said it would be me.
I don't blame you for saying that. I would have said the same.
I think he was trying to inject like a little bit of humour to it, but that was the last thing he said to me, and that was when it started. And I went down. From injecting the fuse, cutting it into two different locations, to using the... When I say you steam it open, you use a lance like you do off a Karcher steamer. It is actually a Karcher steamer. You just make sure that it's above 114 degrees centigrade. And you stand... There is a saddle that you can fit to the bomb and do it remotely using pulleys and winches and stuff. But... Four and a half days into my relationship with my bomb, we've been so intimate. Then standing on the bomb, giving it a little wash, I thought, well, you've been nice to me now, so you're not going to do it now. So I stood and I got told off for it because I didn't do it remotely. I stood with the lance and I washed the inside of the bomb and I washed the explosive out.
Washed it out.
Collected it on Hessian. Gave it to what's called the crash crew. They're the people that come down and give you all the support with the building of temporary works and everything, all that good stuff. Gave it to them and they take it off and burn it in some farmer's field and it just burns like a really good fire.
So, amazing. Unbelievable. I'm really pleased I met you in the village pub.
So am I.
Over those 3 days, did things flash through your mind at all? I mean, I know that you're in the zone. I know you're professional. I know you've been trained. But was there any situations where you thought about the lady you love? Was there any situations where you thought, fuck it, I wish I'd bought them jeans?
Once. After we tried the first cut. Now, you've got to remember that the bombs are made off steel, iron, that we were doing it in Britain as well. We were taking push bikes, fence railings, we were taking lamp posts, anything that would melt it down and make it into a bomb. The Germans were doing exactly the same. So the quality of the metal was very hit and miss. So when we put the first cut in, bear in mind we didn't know what was going to happen. I walked down. It's quite funny, but I'd done the first cut.
I don't think any of this is funny.
I did the first cut. I walked down to the point where the bomb was. Took my stuff off, apart from breathing apparatus, because of the fumes that were going to be coming out of this thing. Were probably going to be bad for me.
Hazardous, yeah.
Yeah. So took everything off. I had my air cylinders in front of me. And I was hopping them in front, because I was crawling them hands and knees, because that's how small the space was. So I hopped them in front of me, and the bomb's now on my left-hand side. When I've looked at the bomb, I could hear the sss, and I thought, oh,
really?
I broke the seal on my mask by turning my head. So I've tightened my mask up, and I've looked again. Sss, oh, I'm really not needing this. This is really not helping. Done my mask up again. And I've looked, and then I thought, wait a minute, ears like mine that point that way, I can hear very well this way. I can't hear very well that way. Likewise, you'll find people who have ears that aren't shaped like mine will do that hear from that way. I don't have to. But when I was turning my head, I could hear something, and when I was turning my head away from it, I couldn't. So I looked at the bomb again, heard the hiss, and I held the mask onto my face to make sure the seal was tight. And when I realised, when I took a breath and the mask sucked itself onto my face, I realised I've got an airtight seal here. It's the bomb that's frying. And that's the point where you don't know whether it's going to get hot enough to detonate,
right,
or whether it's going to cool down.
And you can't rush the process any more than what you're doing.
No. So at that point, I crawled back out. I went back and I said to the senior EOD commander, that thing's frying. And he said, what are we going to do? I said, wait. And he said, how long? I went, I don't know. I waited about 15 minutes, again, just sat on my own. In about 15 minutes, I picked up put all my stuff on, and he looked and he just put his thumbs up. And I nodded my head and he went, okay. That's all I seen was from a distance. I'm going, so I walked down again. But that walk, I didn't know whether it was going to get hot enough to detonate as I was getting closer to it, or what was happening.
That was the scariest time?
That was the worst one, because it was now doing something that nobody had expected. Nobody had ever tested this. It was the first time it ever happened. So when I was walking down to make that approach this time, I was walking down, not really thinking about much, but I noticed that my steps were getting smaller. Right. Not that I was thinking about my steps. I think it was just the buildings around me weren't passing as fast as they should have.
Yeah.
And I thought, why is that happening? And then I looked down, and my steps were probably only about 12 inches, maybe 10 inches, and they were getting shorter and shorter. And that's when I had to say, Doug, come on. Just forget about everything else. Just open your legs.
I hear the saying, does your life flash before you? Or was that just...
It didn't flash. Slow. Everything's very, very slow. You've got all the time in the world. Everything's slow motion. And I forced myself to extend my legs little by little until I was taking a proper stride. And once I was in the proper stride, then I just... All I concentrated on was... Keep that stride until I got to it. And then once I was there, it doesn't matter, because if you go now, you're gone. I'm gone.
So you got there, and I'm assuming the hissing had gone?
Got there, took everything off, went back inside. No hissing, but I could see the steam coming off from where the cutting fluid was off, so it was still hot.
My hands are getting clammy, and I know the outcome.
So it was still hot, but it was cooling. But... The, like I said, the material, the bombs, the casings weren't very, very uniform. You had hard spots, you had soft spots, you had thick points, you had thin points. So I hadn't cut through all of it, so I couldn't take a disc out. So I had to set it off again. But nobody had done it before, and what they didn't realise is where you set the cut up from, it thinks it's at 12 o'clock, so it cuts to 1 o'clock.
Right.
So it gives you a full 360 and a little bit more.
Right.
And that's what happened. So I thought, I'll just set it off again. So I set the next cut off, thinking it would cut on the same plane, but it didn't because it thinks it's at 12 o'clock again. So it's went from 12 o'clock to 1 or 2 o'clock, and then it cuts at 12 o'clock again. So it cut on a different plane, and it didn't go through again. So we had to do a third cut. Now that we'd figured out why it was doing this, we did a third cut, a slower cut. So all in all, I think there was four approaches. It was the fourth cut that took the first disc out. But to obviously wash something out, I need somewhere to put the hot steam in and somewhere for the explosive to wash out. Now, the cutting equipment, it was big, it was cumbersome. The first disc was cut on the top. I need an opposing hole. So I was sat in the protective works on my own. There's nothing I can do. There's absolute the equipment, it's too big, it's too cumbersome to move. It's never been. So all I did was I shuffled up and got nice and comfy, me and my friend, and I dug my heels in to the ground. And I thought, here we go, one, two,
and you kicked it.
Three, and I rolled it with my back. And I rolled it enough so that I could get to the opposite side, so that I could go through the same process to get the opposing hole, because without the opposing hole, it was still going to have the explosive in it. So I had to move it, and that was the only way I could move it.
And you did that, found your opposing hole, and I guess...
Then it was steaming it out. Once the main fills out, all you've got is a little fuse, probably the size of a monster energy drink can.
Yeah.
Very little explosive in there, so very easy to deal with. Just pop it off, and that's it.
You might not want to answer this. Did you collapse, or was there? What's your next move? You come out there and you scored the winning goal in a cup final kind of thing. What? Or you come out and you're shattered. What? How was it for you? What was?
Probably a little bit strange. It was a little bit strange. So it was finished. It was done. They told the police to collapse the cordon and everything else. So people had started to fill into houses and flats and the area. We'd knocked the protective works down and everything. So it's now just an empty metal case that we got a 360 excavator with a set of strops, and picked it up and put it onto the back off the response vehicle, because it's now got nothing in it. And it popped on and it drove off into the distance.
You did get recognised for your bravery, didn't you?
I did, yes.
You got awarded.
I did.
A very, very special medal.
I did. There's only so many people until now, and there's only so many people that know exactly what happened that day, and the ins and outs. However, some of the senior officers and my commanding officers who were privy to what happened, they put in a report, and they put it forward to the Honours and Awards Board. They looked at it and it came back, I was then informed, quite strangely, I don't know if the stars lining up, but on the 7th of March, on my 33rd birthday, I got told that I'd been awarded the Queen's Gallantry Medal. 7 being my birthday, and 3-3 being the regiment that I was with. So on the 7th of March, on my 33rd birthday, I got the Queen's Gallantry Medal, where I went to Buckingham Palace, and King Charles now, Prince Charles then, but King Charles awarded me with the Queen's Gallantry Medal, which is over there.
Which I've been lucky enough to see and hold.
Yes.
That's the least you deserved. The least you deserved. An amazing thing to have. I want to ask you, you told me when we sat down that you went back for the first time for 17 years.
Yep.
I don't know how even to ask this question. How did you feel?
I knew I wouldn't sleep last night because it's very strange. And I was talking to my wife about it, and I said to you earlier on, I said, people can understand if you had a situation in Afghanistan or in Iraq where you only had a 1 in 3 chance of making it out alive, they could understand why you wouldn't want to go back and how you could feel anxious, or you could be nervous, or you could be on edge. And that was kind of how I was feeling when I was walking up to that area, because that was the space in my life where I had to come to terms with, perhaps you're not coming back today.
For sure.
So standing today...
Well, not to, I mean, that was over probably a 4-day course as well, wasn't
it?
Yeah,
it was nearly 5 days. 5 days it was, and all. But I'm standing there today on the same bridge, and I took a photograph on the exact spot where I was stood, looking down the canal, having my final cup of tea, which could have been my final cup of tea. And I walked back down past the inner cordon, which now had a scaffold wagon parked in, unloading. And I walked down to where the building site was. It's still a building site, funny enough. I hope they're just doing some new stuff to the buildings that they built. Otherwise, it's taken 17 years to build these. Well, to build these
just
flats.
Just shows you how slow our planning system is.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. I hope it's not the same flats, the same buildings that they're trying to erect. But yeah, so I went down, and that was a little bit strange. Stood there, looking
sadness,
at the buildings.
Sadness, happiness, fear.
No.
Proud.
Yeah. A little bit off. This is all here because on that day I won. And it is that kind of feeling. It was a competition between me and that munition. And that's what it was. It was a competition. That's why nobody else was taking it, because it's like someone finishing your crossword halfway through your cup of tea.
Some of your analogies, seriously, I do not get. Trust me, I do not get. Listen, I knew when I met you in the pub, I knew there was something special about you. What you've just explained takes a special human being to do. I certainly know I couldn't do it. I've always been very proud of the military, as I've said. I think the awards you've got, nobody can ever take away. I bet you miss your little bomb mate, didn't you?
I've got his nose at home. When
it's the least you could have. You could keep that.
When the fuse was destroyed, then the case cracked. And I've got the nose mounted on a display in a fireplace at home, along with two little round discs might have came from the bomb as well.
Well,
but that's it. That's all I've got.
That's the
honest.
Least you deserve. I'm surprised that we don't have a statue up here for you, to be honest, because it could have caused a load of carnage. I knew when I met you, as I said, you were brave. Thank you very much for what you did from the residents. And as I say, I did walk over that area. So hundreds of times, hundreds and hundreds of times, as many other millions of people have done. So thank you for doing that. Military do a great job. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Really enjoyed your company. Always do, mate. Enjoyed your company.
Thanks for having me.
Viewers, listeners, there's one thing that's going to stick with me on this is I'm never going out to buy a pair of jeans ever again, just in case somebody tries to sign me up or something like that. It'd be a disaster if I did. But this man, very special man. I hope you've really enjoyed the podcast. I'm sort of lost for words, as I was then. Not often that happens. But I hope you've really enjoyed the episode. Take care. Stay safe. Thanks. Bye-bye.